for putting this very important issue on the agenda, for organizing this, and for inviting me and my co-chair, Jamie Love, to guide you through this session this afternoon. I'm very excited to chair this all-women panel on free trade agreements and access to medicines. We have a number of very experienced and very well-informed speakers on this subject. They're going to try to keep to time so that we will have enough time left for questions and answers and for discussion with you. Now, a few words on why it is important for the AIDS community to be concerned about what is happening in the negotiations on so-called free trade agreements. I actually usually don't use the word free because those trade agreements aren't all that free. But it goes back a little bit to 2001 when the WTO ministerial conference adopted the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and public health, which was clearly partly in response to the enormous access to medicines crisis that was in particularly seen in with regard to AIDS. Of course, when the global rules on patenting were negotiated at during the Uruguay round, running up to the establishment of the World Trade Organization, the AIDS pandemic did not exist. I think if the AIDS pandemic had existed, we would not have the global patent rules we have today. And in a way, the Doha Declaration was a bit of a recognition of that. And the Doha Declaration in 2001 says, therefore, that these agreements need to be implemented in such a way that the members, that the countries, retain their right to protect public health, and in particular, that they can promote access to medicines for all. This agreement also outlined a number of mechanisms that can be used in patent law by authorities to remedy problems that pharmaceutical patenting causes. For example, the agreement talks about the use of compulsory licensing, that is a mechanism to basically set patents aside to allow generic competition to take place. It created a new rule for the least developed countries that do not have to grant or enforce pharmaceutical product patents until 2016, and it clarified a number of other things. That is very good news. That is definitely very good news, and we see that some countries begin to use it, but there's also a backlash, and that is what this session is going to be about, because what we have seen since 2001 is a number of trade agreements, in particular with the United States, bilateral or regional trade agreements that have intellectual property chapters that very severely restrict the space that was created through the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and public health. And I'll just give you a few examples, and the speakers will go into it in further detail, but these trade agreements, for example, introduce new exclusive rights, such as data exclusivity. It often turns the drug regulatory agency into a kind of patent policing mechanisms so that the drug regulatory agency cannot register drugs when they are patented. They cannot register the generic versions of them. In some of the agreements, the patent term is extended to beyond the so-called minimum term called for in the WTO rules. Countries are forced to provide patents for new uses of known compounds, something the TRIPS agreement, for example, does not demand. And in many of those agreements, we see restrictions introduced on the use of compulsory licensing. Now, these are all reasons for all of us to be quite worried about what is happening. An additional problem with these agreements are that they are often negotiated in secrecy, that the drafts are often not available, and that we don't find out of what's exactly in it and what the consequences are until after the deal is done. So without further ado, I would like to invite Gabriela Chavez from Brazil to talk to us about what she knows about, in particular, regional trade agreements, NAFTA, CAFTA, and the effects that may have on access to medicines. Gabriela.
Thank you, Ellen. Good afternoon. I would also like to thank Anand for this important session, since the free trade agreements and TRIPS Plus provision are strongly affecting the sustainability of access to medicines policies for the future and also now. So just first I would like to say that where are we after TRIPS? we have gained several of experience after these 13 years of enforcement of TRIPS. The first one is that competition is the best way to get price reduction and consequently to improve access to medicine. Also, that the patent medicines in their monopoly situation and high price has affected the access to medicine policies in developing countries. And there was, during these years, a big effort to implement some TRIPS flexibility, such as Alan said, which is the case of compulsory license. After 10 years, more than 10 years, Thailand implemented and Brazil implemented, but it's an ongoing effort for the future medicines. And we did not have so much innovation suitable for developing country needs. So this graph from Médecins Sans Frontières is just an example on how competition was crucial to get price reduction. And I would also like to highlight which experience civil society has gained during these years. The first one was the support of the use of TRIPS flexibility. The use of pre-grant oppositions to avoid the granting of improper patents. This case is very special because it promotes a strong share of experience between civil society of developing country. We learned a lot from India and Thailand, and I think this will be one of the issues that we will need to explore for the future. We need to avoid the improper patents. And there was also we had a very strong international support from developing countries to local initiatives, and the need to find a solution inside the current system, the patent system, which is a very strong discussion in the international level. And now UNITAID is considering the patent pool as an alternative inside the system. And this is some of this experience we have gained during this year. Just an example, the compulsory license of Thailand was a very important, not only for Thailand, but for developing countries. This is an example of how the price got down after price negotiations and also after the compulsory license. And then this had an impact on also on other developing countries, since Abbott announced the reduction for middle-income countries, such as the case of Brazil. So now we are in the situation, in the scenario where we won't have the easy source of generic versions coming from India, and we need to think in another way. So what do we need to do now to keep using the public health TRIPS flexibility, to keep avoiding the granting of improper patents, to think about the importance of stimulate local production of essential health technologies, and to avoid more than ever TRIPS plus provision. Also to find ways to stimulate innovations for developing countries' needs. So getting to the TRIPS plus provision focus, these are the TRIPS, public health TRIPS flexibilities we have now. First of all, we need them in our legislation. But this will be the way to promote competition with generics. But if we have the TRIPS plus provision included, such as the restriction of compulsory license, this will affect the use of this public health flexibility. If we got the linkage between drug market approval and patent status, this will affect the Boller exception, which is a public health flexibility that allows the generic to present the tests to get the registration before the patent expires. So if we include the linkage, we are deleting the Boller exception. Also, there are the extension of patent term beyond 20 years, the exclusivity of data submitted for registration, the data protection. The two other examples that is already proposed in other FTAs already signed is the limitation of using oppositions, so which has been shown to be very effective, and also to propose broad criteria for pharmaceutical patent examination, such as Alan said, to grant patents for second use for polymorphs and etc. So we need to avoid that, otherwise we won't have ways to promote competition. So going to the specific cases of FTAs between U.S. and America, just to highlight this, we have also CAFTA that I will leave to Lidzi that will explain, go further on the details. And that's why this is very important to discuss, because we have already two bilateral agreements between U.S. and Colombia and Panama pending congressional approval. We have also NAFTA that was before TRIPS, so it was already an announcement of the future scenario. Also the Chile and U.S. and the Peru and U.S. pending implementation. Just a very brief overview. These agreements are already proposing the restriction for compulsory license, the linkage between drug market approval and patent status, and the data protection and extension beyond 20 years. But TRIPS Plus provisions are not only proposed in FTAs. Countries that are not signing FTAs with IP chapters should be aware in the same effort. The example of Brazil is very important because in the legislative, we have a bill from 2006 proposing the inclusion of linkage between patent and medicines registration. So although we have the BOLR provision in our law, since 1996, this bill is putting this flexibility under risk. So civil society should be aware of what's being proposed also in the legislative level. Another example in Brazil is the revision of the guideline for pharmaceutical patent examination. The Brazilian Patent Office is proposing a revision which excludes the participation of civil society, and they are proposing to grant patents for second use and polymorphs, allowing the evergreening patent protection. So this is another way to include evergreening and to include the TRIPS Plus provision in our countries. I want to discuss this one. So I will finish my presentation with more questions than answers. How to prioritize our efforts to guarantee long-term access to essential medicines? To promote the use of flexibility, to avoid the granting of improper patents, to avoid the inclusion of TRIPS Plus provision, to monitor FTAs, monitor bill in the Congress, monitor favorable decisions in the courts, favorable to pharmaceutical companies. So that I think this is a big challenge for civil society and government in developing countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriela, for this very useful overview. And you're putting out quite an agenda for civil society there. So that I'm sure will help with the discussion. I would like to invite the second speaker, Sanja Reed-Smith from TWN Third World Network. She is based in Australia, and she will talk about the nature of free trade agreements, their role in the global economy, and the proposed U.S.-Malaysia free trade agreement. Sanja.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm actually based in Malaysia, but never mind. As you know, a patent is a monopoly on a medicine, and it means that only one company can sell the medicine. So that means that they can charge as high a price as they like. And what we're talking about here is not just the TRIPS level of protection, because 153 countries are members of the World Trade Organization, and that sets the minimum levels of patent protection in an agreement called TRIPS. So this session is about how the intellectual property rules are being made to go even stronger, and we call that TRIPS Plus. So, as Gabriela said, some of your laws may already be TRIPS Plus, even if you haven't signed a free trade agreement. And this might be through bilateral pressure, for example, with the US Special 301, where they go around to your countries and say, we'll do things to your trade and tariffs on your exports unless you agree to stronger intellectual property protection. But this is often an empty threat, and maybe Jamie can talk more about this. Then there are free trade agreements with these countries in particular, which lead to TRIPS Plus provisions. I'll talk about the European Union ones a bit more later. But the European Free Trade Association with Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway and Switzerland can also bring in these TRIPS Plus provisions. So who are they signing with? They've already signed free trade agreements with Chile, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Mexico, Morocco, Singapore, the Southern African Customs Union, South Africa, Namibia, Lesotho, Swaziland, Botswana, South Korea, Tunisia, and Turkey. They are still negotiating with Algeria, India, Indonesia, Russia, Thailand, Colombia, Peru, and the Gulf Cooperation Council, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi, and United Arab Emirates. What do these free trade agreements have? Well, they vary a bit, and it looks like if you resist, they will drop some of their TRIPS Plus demands. But they do have this data exclusivity that Ellen talked about, which is a monopoly even when there's no patent. So even when there is no patent, you can't get the generic medicine for at least 5 years. They also have longer patents, so the monopoly doesn't just go for 20 years, it may go for 25 years. These are patent term extensions. Of course, the US free trade agreements have the most TRIPS Plus provisions, and that's what Gabriella and Leticia will be talking about, so I won't focus on those. For Japan, this is an interesting one. They've already signed with Brunei, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, Chile, and Mexico. They are also negotiating with South Korea and India. And the Japanese free trade agreements often have a very strong investment chapter, which can cause you problems with accessing generic medicines, which I'll talk about more later. Okay, here's the long list of countries negotiating with the EU. It's alphabetical by column, and I'm sorry, the country names are in English, so it's English order. And if there's a question mark, it means that the negotiations may be stalled, like Mercosur, or it's not clear if the country will be included, like the least developed countries in ASEAN, or the negotiations may not have yet started, like Russia. So, can you see your country on this slide? Or this one? It keeps going. There's about 120 countries. So most developing countries in the world are negotiating with the European Union. How about this slide? So, is there anybody in this room who is not negotiating a free trade agreement with the European Union? It's a lot of countries. So, the European Union, again, has a variety of TRIPS Plus provisions. And again, if your government resists, it looks like the European Union will drop some of the demands. But they ask your country to join two treaties, which can mean that you get more patent applications, so you get more patents on medicines. In countries like Vietnam, they had 15 times as many patents on medicines as before they joined these two treaties. There could also be longer patents, like in the US free trade agreements, beyond the 20 years. They could also have this data exclusivity monopoly even when there's no patent, which could be for 10 years, which is what they asked South Korea for. South Korea said no, so the European Union dropped it. So if you can persuade your government, and we'll talk later about how PLHIV have managed to do that, then that looks like they will drop some of the demands. They also have this linkage that Ellen mentioned, which is where your Ministry of Health has to become the patent police. And this effectively stops compulsory licensing. So some of you were at the session last night where you heard about the new compulsory licenses. And this means that even if a medicine is patented, your government can allow the generic version to be imported or made, and they just have to pay a small royalty, like 0.5%. So the medicine becomes very affordable. This is not possible if you agree to this linkage provision. They also try to undermine parallel importation, where your country can import the cheaper patented medicine from another country. In addition, the European Union has some special TRIPS Plus provisions that we don't normally see in US free trade agreements. These are new tricks. One is they ask you to agree to regional patents. This is quite unusual. Usually you have to apply for a patent in every country in order to get it. A patent is national. So if you're from a country with a small population, like a Pacific island with 10,000 people, of which maybe 5 people have HIV, the big pharma, the pharmaceutical companies, are not going to come to your country to apply for a patent on the medicine, translate the application into the local language, hire local lawyers, pay the fee every year, because the market is too small. It's only 5 people. So you'll find in countries with small populations, you don't have many patents on medicines, comparatively. But what happens is if you join into this regional patent system, then suddenly a group of 10 of you have a much bigger population. So they just apply once and they get a patent in all 10 countries. So in the Pacific, if they have a regional patent system with Fiji and Papua New Guinea, suddenly it's a market of 5 million people and it's worth applying for patents, and you would expect many more medicines to be patented in the Pacific Islands. The second trick we've seen the European Union try to do is they try to get your countries to agree to harmonise your laws with the European Union's. The European Union gives 11 years of data exclusivity, even if there's no patent. That's a monopoly of 11 years when you cannot get a generic medicine. They allow patents on all kinds of things that should not probably get a patent. So if you have to harmonise your law to theirs, suddenly you give the strong level of intellectual property protection that the European Union gives, and it's much harder for you to access generic medicines. The other trick they try to do is about enforcement of patents. And this is where they seize things that they think are infringing at the border. And at the WTO, this only has to be for fake Rolex watches and fake copyright things like DVDs and CDs. But the European Union wants to extend this to patented products. But how does your poor customs official know when they look at a medicine, it's a white tablet, the patented version is a white tablet, the generic version is a white tablet, how do they know that the generic is infringing the patent or not? So they just seize all the generics. Now, eventually they release them, but you probably have to pay a big bond, and it's probably too much for the generic companies to afford, and it also catches things that are transited through free warehouses. So I understand, like, MSF might ship things to Burundi through South Africa, because South Africa is an airport hub. South Africa may have a patent on the medicine, but you just transit through a warehouse in South Africa, so you're not really infringing the patent in South Africa, and you can get it to Burundi, which is the least developed country and doesn't have to have patents. But this European Union one would catch even those things. And it also applies to even the least developed countries. They just get a bit longer to implement it. The other way is for the 40 or so countries that are not yet members of the World Trade Organization, like most Pacific Islands, you don't have to have patents on anything. But in the process of joining the World Trade Organization, you may be forced to accept these TRIPS Plus provisions. Because the WTO is a club, and all the existing 153 countries, including the US, the European Union, Switzerland, have to agree to let you in. And they can impose any conditions they like on you to get in. So they can ask you for TRIPS Plus patents of 30 years, and you have to give it if you want to get in. Regional patent offices, I explained the problem, and bilateral investment treaties we'll talk about now. So, a bilateral investment treaty is not a free trade agreement. It's a standalone agreement on investment. But you can also get the same provisions in the investment chapter of a free trade agreement. Why are we talking about this? Well, because they have this broad definition of investment. It includes patents, it includes the data that's used to approve a medicine, and it includes basically everything usually. Even market share, profit, expected market share. Then if it also has this expropriation provision, it means that if your government does anything that reduces the value of this broad definition of investment, your government can be sued at an international tribunal by the company, and if it loses, it has to pay full compensation, including interest. So, what does this mean? Data exclusivity means you can't approve a generic on the basis of the pharmaceutical company, the originator company's clinical trial data. So, if you ever do approve a generic, you have reduced the market share of the originator company, you've reduced their profit, you've expropriated their investment possibly. So, your government has to pay them full compensation for every box of medicine they would have sold if there were no generics being sold in your country, including interest. So that means your government would never allow a generic to be sold, and this is called infinite data exclusivity. Similarly, how would you ever issue a compulsory license? Because if you do, you reduce the value of the patent, you reduce their market share, you reduce their profit, you have expropriated their investment, you have to pay them the full price of every box of medicine they would have sold, plus interest. And the investor state dispute settlement is how the company sues your government. The difference is that in a free trade agreement, so in a bilateral investment treaty, the company sues your government at the international tribunal for expropriating their patent. Your government loses, they're supposed to pay $30 million, they don't pay, nothing happens. But if these same provisions are included in a free trade agreement, then your government is sued by the company at the international tribunal. Your government loses. They're supposed to pay $30 million. They can't afford it because they're Ethiopia. So they don't pay. In a free trade agreement, that would allow the developed country, the home of the pharmaceutical company, to put tariffs, taxes, on all the exports from Ethiopia until the money has been made up. So it really has teeth. And this is particularly the case in Japanese free trade agreements because it has all of this and there are no exceptions for health. Okay, finishing up. What can PLHIV do about all this? I'm not from Thailand, but Thai PLHIV, as you know, have been very inspiring in what they've done, both to fight these TRIPS Plus provisions and also to use compulsory licensing. And there's actually a book here that's in the Global Village, in stall 104 and 408, which talks about how Thai PLHIV did all this. And at the start, there's a chapter that explains what is a compulsory license, what is a patent, what is TRIPS Plus provisions. You can also get this from apnplus.org because it's by the Asia Pacific Network for People Living with HIV/AIDS. And there's also a poster that goes with it, which explains, I know it looks a bit complicated, it explains whether, how to find out if there's a patent on a medicine in your country, whether you are a WTO member, whether you need a compulsory license, and you kind of follow your way through the jungle, and it's supposed to make your life a bit easier in this area. And of course, in Malaysia, the people living with HIV/AIDS have been leaders in writing letters to the editor, in demonstrations. You can see here they made a coffin. They left it outside the Ministry of Trade and said, "You are killing us," in these negotiations with the US. They had T-shirts saying FTA kills. And in Thailand, PLHIV were also key in bringing the negotiations with the US to a halt. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Sanya, for this presentation, which on the one hand raises a lot of concerns, but on the other hand is also very encouraging in the sense that it does show, and in many countries we've seen that resistance works and that a lot of this can be prevented if you get organized to make that happen. I would like to introduce our last panelist, Lidice Lopez. I don't dare to say anymore where she's from, but I believe she's from Peru, living in Guatemala. But if I'm wrong again, please do correct me. And she's going to talk to us about trade agreements in Latin America and access to medicines.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm very pleased of being here to talk about some issues we're facing in Latin America. Okay. Due to this free trade agreement we are negotiating, or we already have in this region. But first, I want to highlight some issues from the HIV epidemic in Latin America. We have almost 2 million people with HIV in the region. The figure says that we have already 73% of those in need of treatment already receiving it, but Brazil and the South countries has a strongly influence in this percentage. And of course, in the small and poorest countries that are in Central America, like Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua, less than 50% of those in need actually are getting ARVs. And of course, this is not only because FTAs, we have other barriers to access ARVs, lack of access, and to testing, low rates of literacy, poverty, centralization of health facilities, medical attention or drug fees that we have to pay, transportation, accommodation, the cost, limited access to laboratory tests, stigma, discrimination, and on top of everything, we have intellectual property rules that we have to follow. So, how are these IP, intellectual property provision, included in the FTAs? And I'm going to talk briefly about NAFTA and CAFTA. I don't know if you can see it, but the NAFTA and CAFTA included compensations for delays to grant a patent. And these compensations are granted because unreasonable delays, yes. And the same situation was in the second row, we can see it. And are supposed to be granted if the sanitary registration is delayed too. And an unreasonable delay depends on the country. In the case of Nicaragua and Honduras and El Salvador, they legislated and said that an unreasonable delay is more than 5 years. But in Guatemala, that you're going to see a little bit later, with a strong influence of pharmaceuticals, they actually said that more than 3 months is an unreasonable delay. And another issue included in the FTAs, NAFTA and CAFTA, is the linkage between the sanitary registration authority and the patent that limit the limit generic drugs to enter the market in a certain country. And, well, we, Ellen and Gabriela and Sanya already mentioned this data protection and exclusivity that are included in FTAs. So even when a pharmaceutical is not patented, as Sanya mentioned, it, they got a monopoly for 5 years. In Mexico and all Central America and Dominican Republic. So what is and could be the potential impact of this FDA? And we are already seeing it. We have extension of patent from 20 years to 25 years at least if we have this unreasonable delay. We have, due to data protection or linkage, we have these new restrictions to introduce generic drugs, and of course we have limited access to ARVs treatment, especially for new drugs that are widely promoted here. So I'm going to present some examples of what's happening in Latin America. Chile, from 1991, they allowed patents, and until 2004, 5,500 pharmaceutical patents were filed. And as you can see the figures, only 692 were granted, another bunch of them were rejected, and 3,082 are still on analysis. So if we, if Chile had had this FDA sooner, there, those pharmaceuticals could be granted an extension. So from 20 to 25 years. And in Costa Rica, we have some data from 2006, and it happened the same. So from 595 patent application, only 7 were evaluated, so they couldn't have this extension. And in Guatemala, they are currently collecting some data to analyze what's going on with this data protection that, well, Guatemala has a very curious scenario. But Guatemala has data protection from 2000, and then the law was changed 5 times. And because of that, well, some generics were are not entering the market right now. So they have made an analysis, and the cost has increased from 249% to 846%, more than non-data protection, non-data protected drug, I'm sorry. And, of course, linkage is being used to delay entry into the market by generic companies for particular products. And this delay could last for years. And and, of course, rich countries and pharmaceutical enterprises keep pushing forward or backward, depending on how we see it. And, well, we had this many changes in Guatemala legislation in 2004. Data protected was included in the legislation for 15 years. So Caletra and other 21 drugs are protected, has this data protection for 15 years. It's around until 2020 or something, or around that time. So even though these drugs are not patented, they have the monopoly, so they can put the price they want. And this is this pharmaceutical pressuring and this rich countries pressuring is also happening in South America. For example, Peru filed an amendment to the Andean community to change the industrial application criteria of a patent, to grant a patent for the criteria of utility. Well, it wasn't accepted, but in Peru, pharmaceuticals are still pushing. And in Colombia, they have the linkage, even though it's not legal yet because the FDA has not been approved yet. So what to do, or what are we doing in Latin America? We should keep monitoring changes on legislation to prevent FTI plus, which Sania explained, and we have some organization working on that. And we have to be aware of what European Union and EFTA are proposing for this new FTAs we are negotiating. And of course, we should we have to closely follow the impact of FTA on prices of medicine in order to assure access to drugs and prevent any harm to public health in other countries. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, leadership, for this for this overview, and for also giving us some examples of the practical consequences of these new rules that are indeed quite worrisome. I'm now going to hand over to my co-chair, Jamie Love, who's going to make a few introductory remarks to kick off the question and answer and discussion session. You want to?
Is there a storm or something in this room? It's really... It's rain? Okay. I'm glad I'm inside then. I thought all the three presentations were even better than I've ever heard them before. They're really great. And I'm guessing for some people in the audience it must be kind of a range of backgrounds. There's probably some people in the audience that know a lot about patent law or other types of parts of intellectual property laws, or know a lot about trade, and there's probably other people out here that don't know very much about that, or find kind of confusing the whole trade idea. So, I'd also like to echo the comment that it was really great that Adam Grover set up this panel, because he's identified a really important thing for people living with AIDS and other illnesses, which is, are these agreements that were described by the panelists, are they going to frustrate all these other things that are going on at this meeting? Are they going to make it harder for people to get access to generic drugs at lower prices? And the details are complicated, but the effects are very practical and they're very real. And it's hard for a lot of people, I think, here, because the agreements are negotiated as part of a much bigger part of the government's policy. They may be focusing on trade in bananas or textiles or investments in telecommunications equipment or things like that. So the range of considerations in a country are so complicated that sometimes the people in the health ministries are almost not consulted or don't know much about the agreements. That's unfortunate. So we'll have a discussion, and people should talk about, you know, get you know, they should ask questions. I would say that there's quite a few people in the NGO community and in the UN community who have the capacity to provide information about these things. I know that Anna's group is really one that's really it does a fabulous job. There's a lot of the southern NGOs here, the Thai, you know, group that was referred to, the South African group. There's a lot of groups that work in the field. There's big organizations like Oxfam and MSF, and then groups like mine or HealthGap, Paris ACT UP, that work on these issues. So, and I think building ties between North and South, I think that is kind of important, because often the pressure is often coming from the European Commission, Japan, or the United States. And so it's not a bad idea to develop some strategy to communicate so that you can work it. But I think right now people were very good about their time. I'll try and be good about my time. And I think we'll go right now into a question and answer. And people should be free to kind of come up to the microphone. What we'll probably do is probably take about a half dozen questions first, and then ask the panelists to respond to those half dozen questions. So anyone who wants to, sorry, if you could start off by maybe identifying yourself, and then go ahead and speak.
Good evening, Enga Kamenis.
Yes.
Good evening, Enga Kamenis, my name. I'm a trade and investment lawyer specializing on access to medicine, and I also teach international trade and access to medicine in a couple of universities in South Africa. First and foremost, I would like to say it's unfortunate that nobody from Africa is presented on the panel, irrespective of the fact that we know the impact that the disease is having in Africa, as well as the potential impact of FTAs that African countries are at the verge of signing. I would like to make two comments, which will go to Sanya. Sorry. The first is that the U.S. and SACU, they had some agreement, but it collapsed. And these agreements had envisaged TRIPS Plus provisions, but fortunately, it collapsed. So whether or not it will be resurrected is another question. And secondly, you made mention of the EU. The EU has what is called economic partnership agreements with African countries. And from my understanding and of it is that at the moment, intellectual property issues have been put aside. Whether or not they will figure in the full EPAs is another issue that policyholders are not able to tell us at this time. And that was just a comment. The last comment is a question that goes to Lopez. I read some literature by Carlos Correa, which says that a study was being conducted before the U.S. went into the FTAs with the Andean community. And this study shows that the proposed FTAs at the time will have negative implications on the Andean community. So what do you think pushed these countries into entering the FTAs with the U.S.? Do you think it was pressure? Do you think it was as a result of some of trade-offs or economic benefits? So I would just like to have an idea on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hello?
Potential panelist, obviously.
Hi, I'm Mark Milano with HealthGap. I want to echo what Jamie said about the importance between communication between North and South. This all really began when the U.S. attempted to stop South Africa from making generic drugs. And we won that battle by activists in the U.S. hitting the U.S. government hard and activists in South Africa working hard in South Africa, and we won. And I think in any of these situations, it has to be activists in America want to hit our government. And if activists in the other country are hitting their government, I think that's the way we work. The problem is that I didn't know about these extra things of going into the legislature to get the extra 15-year data, all those little things. So many of them are happening that we're not aware of them. I want to ask the panelists, is there a way we could set up a clearinghouse where we could all know what's going on everywhere, so we in America know when to pressure our government, so ACT UP Paris knows when to pressure the EU, so we can all be doing this at the same time, because that's the way we're going to win if we're hitting it from both fronts. Do people see that a clearinghouse could work and would be useful so we can all be on the same page?
Thanks. Also, for people that, if I don't know if people know this, but Mark played a critical, a really huge role in 1999 in terms of changing the foreign policy of the United States when President Clinton was president and Vice President Gore was the chairman of the South Africa U.S. Bilateral Commission. And because of the efforts of Mark and a number of his colleagues, the Clinton administration changed a lot of its policies in the last year of its office. And so I just like to hope people recognize what an important role he played.
But do the panelists think that that is a useful approach? How would you, you know, propose we go about doing that so we can work together on this? Any ideas from the panelists?
I was just wondering if we were going to go through and like collect a few more questions.
Okay.
But since
okay.
we don't see anybody else at the microphone, well, maybe we do. We're going to first collect six comments and
okay.
then go to the panel
okay,
and come
sure.
back to this question of the clearinghouse.
Hi, I'm Robin Calder with Elma Philanthropies, and my question, or first of all, I think the clearinghouse idea is a great idea. It could be even a website that's regularly updated with a blog, possibly. So I think that's a great idea. My question is, what are the possibilities of using international human rights law and international human rights precedents to combat these patent laws and including patents to life-saving medicines in the free trade agreement? If any of the panelists could speak about efforts, to use international law, human rights law, to fight this, that would be great. Thanks.
So there's another person coming. Yes.
Hi, my name is Laurel Sprague. I'm from the U.S., and I'm, among other things, I'm a student in political science. So my question is that I've heard it claimed many times that these IP protections are necessary in order to maintain incentives for ongoing AIDS research. And I'm wondering if you have any idea or any way to tell us how true this claim is, and if you have any strategies for how we can respond to those claims when they're put to us. Thank you.
Sorry, I don't speak English. Could you please translate from Spanish to English my commentary and my question? Yes? Bueno, vengo de Colombia, que acaba de firmar en las tres instancias reglamentarias el Tratado de Libre Comercio, Presidente, Congreso y Corte Suprema. Solo está pendiente la ratificación del Congreso de Estados Unidos. Yo quisiera que las tres personas del panel, o los dos chairs, comentaran el impacto que en términos de un indicador terrible, que es el que se utiliza en estos casos, como es el de años de vida potencialmente perdidos, está implicando para las personas VIH positivas en nuestros países. Como lo mencionó Lídice, IFARMA y Misión Colombia ya hicieron estos cálculos, porque en mi país se entregan medicamentos genéricos y el país va a mantener el mismo dinero para comprar medicamentos y solamente podrá reducir el acceso a personas, y esto conllevará pérdida de años para nosotros las personas viviendo con VIH. Gracias por el panel.
Everything. He's from Colombia, and he mentioned that Colombia has already signed an FTA, and it's been approved by the Congress and all the instances it needs to be approved. And he wants us to make some comments about this in terms of years of life. How could the impact of FTA could be measured for people living with HIV? He highlighted that IFARMA has already made this measure, I guess. And because the government will keep the same amount of money to buy patented drugs, so he would like us to get a number of years lost, years of life lost because of FTAs, right?
Thank you for that. Very helpful. translation, sir.
My name is David Kalki, currently living in California. At the opening session of the conference, Felipe Calderon indicated that he was going to be lifting restrictions on five medications that would be coming into Mexico. In light of today's conversation, how would we analyze that? Is that a good thing, or should we, as activists around AIDS issues, be concerned about what that might mean for the economy and availability of those drugs here in Mexico?
Which drugs?
I don't think they were named, but there were five drugs that he said were going to, the restrictions are going to be lifted. I believe there were second and third line drugs that are not currently available in Mexico, but they were going to be lifted. It was a promise he made at the opening of the conference.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, we've had I think, yes, one more. Yeah, then we'll go to the panel.
Perhaps I could clarify that. I think what he referred to was, this is already passed. This was passed this last Tuesday, I think. They have eliminated the, it was called requisito de planta, it was a plant requisite. In order to sell a generic drug in Mexico, you needed to have a plant in Mexico, which necessarily made generic drugs prices higher because there would be an intermediate channel distribution. I think that's what he was referring to, and it was already eliminated as of yesterday. There is no need, in order to import any retroviral drugs, there is no need to have a plant here in Mexico. So I think that was what he was talking about.
Okay, that's very helpful. So if we could go to the panels, I'd like to start at my far end with Ms. Lopez, and then move this way. If you could try and sort of keep your, I know that it was a lot of questions. If you could try and maybe initially, sort of focus within about 3 minutes, it would be good.
Okay. First of all, I would like to answer the first question about why we signed these FTAs. And it's a tricky question. But I think that the thing is that people who from our countries who signed those FTAs are actually those who are getting some benefits from it. Let's say some asparagus exporters in Peru, or roses exporters in Colombia, or coffee exporters in Costa Rica. So that's the problem. And we had this information before the FTA in Peru were signed from Carlos Correa. He was part of the negotiating team. But from some effort at the beginning, the Ministry of Health just said, okay, if you say that we're getting all these benefits, okay, we'll probably have this enough money to pay for these drugs. Okay, and they just stopped pressuring our government. And about this this situation here in Mexico, it's not a thing that about intellectual property, actually. It's about the criteria about the market here in Mexico. And I'm sorry, I personally don't have any number for this Colombian friend. We have no information about that.
Thank you for the questions. I agree with you that the Southern African Customs Union did stop negotiating their U.S. free trade agreement, and I understand it was partly because of these TRIPS Plus demands by the U.S., in addition to the effect on South Africa's affirmative action policy. Sorry, when I was talking about free trade agreements, I included their European Union Economic Partnership Agreements or Association Agreements or whatever the different name is. And with Africa, of course, they are not complete yet, but with the Caribbean, the CARIFORUM countries, which is CARICOM plus Dominican Republic, they have signed, initialed a full Economic Partnership Agreement, which does include an intellectual property chapter and does require the Caribbean countries to join the Patent Cooperation Treaty, which was responsible for 15 times as many patent applications on medicines in Vietnam as before they joined. So I would, especially because Caribbean countries are a small market, I would expect that to result in a sudden rise in the number of medicines that are patented in the Caribbean. The African countries, with respect to the European Union, of course, some of them have only gone as far as interim, and none of them, some have not even initialed interim agreements. And I haven't read all of the interim agreements, but some of them are not even legally enforceable, the requirement to negotiate an intellectual property chapter. It's listed there, but there's no dispute settlement mechanism if you fail to have an intellectual property chapter. So for those African countries, they can go ahead and have a no intellectual property chapter, no TRIPS plus FTA. To add to the question about why are our countries signing these things, in some countries, like I understand the Andean countries and Central America, they were, before the free trade agreements, their exports were going to the US with no tariffs or low tariffs, most of their exports, under a unilateral sort of gift from the US. And they thought that they would lose this. And they thought they had to sign the free trade agreement in order to lock this in. But this was not actually the case. The US would never have cut this off. But they believed it. And of course, the countries that have signed US free trade agreements, all of them, their trade balances have worsened, unless they were in some situation like Mexico, where you had a peso depreciation, or Chile, where your copper price went up, or Jordan, where your textile exports increased, and which is not possible anymore. As Jamie said, there are a number of organisations that can help you with this, including the World Health Organization and the United Nations Development Programme. They've been giving very good advice on this area for developing countries. And one thing you can do, and that developing country negotiators often don't seem to know, for example, is that the European Parliament has passed a resolution telling the Commission that they should not negotiate TRIPS Plus provisions in free trade agreements with developing countries. So if your negotiators knew this, they could hold it up in the negotiations and say, look, what are you doing? What are you asking us for? Of course, it doesn't have a lot of legal force, but it is a good political tool. And similarly, the US, as I'm sure Jamie can say, has recently, with the Democrats in power in the Congress, the Parliament, has watered down their free trade agreement demands on TRIPS Plus under this new trade policy. But a lot of developing countries, again, don't know that they can ask for this and have a right to it. So then they just agree to the old system. But the US has slowed down recently because they've lost their fast track, and maybe that will be gone for a few years. So there may not be a lot of new US free trade agreements, but of course, as we heard, the existing ones are already causing problems. With respect to Colombia, sorry, I'm not speaking in Spanish, the World Health Organization had a model which you can use in your own countries to see the impact of agreeing to these TRIPS Plus provisions on medicine prices in your country. And so, for example, for Colombia, before the new trade policy, they said that it would require an extra $1.5 billion to be spent on medicines every year. And if this is not spent, Colombians will have to reduce the amount of medicines they consume by 44%. So which half of your medicines are you going to not afford to buy? And that's not just for HIV medicines. So this model is available to any country that wants to use it before you decide to agree to any of this, either in a free trade agreement or due to bilateral pressure. It's a simple Excel spreadsheet. You put in 10 numbers, you click the button, and it graphs for you the impact on prices and consumption. And you can get that from your WHO local office. The human rights question, it is a good tool. Some countries are more susceptible to it than others. So, for example, Malaysia recently was called before the Committee on the Rights of the Child because that convention includes the right to health. And they were asked, what are you going to do about your US free trade agreement and the impact it will have on affordability of medicines and the children's right to health? So the Attorney General himself had to say, I promise we will not introduce TRIPS Plus provisions. Now, whether that promise is kept is another question, but he had to say it. And we understand that some European countries are particularly susceptible to accusations that they are violating human rights. So, because you can complain to these committees and you can do it anonymously or not anonymously, and if these committees, which they have found over and over again, say that these TRIPS Plus provisions are bad for the right to health, then it causes some European countries to go into paralysis. And the free trade agreement negotiations stop for 2 years while they try to figure out, oh no, we are violating our human rights obligations. I don't think the US at the moment, in the past, cares so much about violating their human rights obligations, but who knows, new president might change. So then the question about TRIPS Plus and research and development. Jamie can probably answer this better than me because I think his organisation did a lot of the studies, but basically this is premised on the claim that, number one, pharmaceutical companies spend a lot on research and development. This is not true for a number of reasons: the tax rebates they get, the funding from the government, the overstating of the costs. Number two, that if you increase intellectual property protection, you'll get more innovation. This is also not true for a number of reasons, because the things you need to do the innovation are patented and then you can't do it. So even Big Pharma has been caught by upstream patents on genes and things. And of course, you get innovation without intellectual property protection, like Linux and open source software. And when you ask the pharmaceutical companies themselves, for example, why aren't you doing R&D in Malaysia? They say it's not the lack of intellectual property protection, it's you don't have enough scientists. Malaysia doesn't have enough pharmacists to stock the pharmacies, let alone to do research and development for the pharmaceutical companies. And of course, there's also the question about, well, if you increase it empirically, have you got more innovation? And when they did in Italy in 1978, they increased their level of intellectual property protection, they got no more inventions. So this link has not been clearly proven, and I can give you more information if you want about that. And then lastly, the Mexican question, as I understand from the explanation, it's not an intellectual property issue, it's an industrial development question that you had to locally manufacture, which presumably meant that Mexico could not import the cheap generic versions from India, for example. And Indian generics are very cheap because they have large economies of scale and labour is cheap. But India is having problems because since 2005, it has had to have patents on medicines. Before that, they didn't, so they could make generic everything, Kalitra, anything. Now it has to have patents on medicines, so it's no longer going to be able to supply so easily the rest of us with the generics we need. And the Lawyers Collective has been doing a great job in India of opposing these patent applications one by one in pre-grant opposition to try and ensure that generic medicines can continue to flow from India to the rest of us who need it. And that's also in this book. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sonia. Gabriel?
No, I would just say very quickly, I think Sonia was very clear and Lidzi as well. So just in the case of the clearinghouse for monitoring the specific problems we have in the local level is a very, very important idea, and I completely agree. And the question of human rights, I just would like to compliment that we have, in the case of America, we have the Inter-American Human Rights Court, and this is a place where we are considering for the future to bring our cases on violation of health regarding patent protection. So I think this is a potential way. And the question about IP and innovation, I think we have the report from World Health Organization, the CIPIH report, with a lot of evidence showing that this is not true for the pharmaceutical field. So that's it.
Well, I'm gonna also ask Ellen Tejon, my co-chairman, if she could offer any comments either on the presentations or on the questions that were asked.
Thank you, Jamie. I just want to take the opportunity to make two brief comments. First of all, the question of whether we are ambitious enough with just saying to, for example, the European Commission, you should not negotiate TRIPS Plus European partnership agreements with African countries, for example. It is indeed true that the European Commission has said when we raised concerns with them, no, we will not do TRIPS Plus with Africa. But we would actually like to ask them to do more, because the European Commission always publicly declares to be a great friend and a great defender of the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health. And just not doing TRIPS Plus to us does not seem to be enough. They could also, in those agreements and in those negotiations, make it very, very clear to countries that they would support support them if they implement the Doha Declaration, and that they would support them if they would make use of the flexibilities that exist in those agreements. So I think we can perhaps in our strategy also be a bit more ambitious, and I think particularly with the European Commission we should do that. I want to quickly say something about the financing of research and development, because of course money for research and development is absolutely crucial, but if your only way to finance research and development is through asking high prices, which you can do because of patent monopolies, two things are happening. First of all, the R&D agenda, the priorities of the R&D agenda are dictated by there where the market opportunities are, which has consequences for which drugs will be developed or which products will be developed and which products will not be developed. There's no denying that there is an enormous amount of research and development going on in AIDS, for example, but there is almost nothing going on in the commercial sector that is specifically targeted to address the needs in, say, sub-Saharan Africa. And that is for very obvious reasons. As a market, that is considered not interesting enough. We've had a number of discussions with pharmaceutical companies, for example, about the need for the development of certain pediatric formulations, and they're quite open with us and saying, well, actually, from a market perspective, that is not so very interesting for us, even though we see that the need is there. The second consequence, of course, is if you finance your research and development through high drug prices, that you end up with products that are very, very expensive, and that leads to inclusion of large numbers of people. And that's why I think it's also important when we talk about intellectual property, we need to talk also about the question, how do you finance research and development, and what are perhaps better ways of doing that, so that we move away from basically using rationing as a way to finance research and development. And some of the speakers already mentioned the WHO's work on this, the Commission on Intellectual Property, Public Health and Innovation, and the WHO recently adopted a global strategy and plan of action that will now look at alternative financing mechanisms, alternatives to the patent system for paying of the R&D and the research and development that will be much more geared towards needs rather than to where the market opportunities are. And I think that is a process that many of us should engage with, and that we should be following very closely.
Well, thank you. I would... I'm going to go back to questions again from the audience in about 1 second. First of all, Mark Milano asked what people thought about this idea of a clearinghouse, and I don't think any of the panel members made reference to it. My own impression was that there's an abundance of information on the internet about things that are going on and all the negotiations, and I think Sonia pointed to bilaterals.org is one of the very good sites. Several groups have in their websites tons of information. It is almost a full-time job, though, to try and track these things, and they're so complicated that, you know, I think it is kind of difficult. I think that, but I think Mark's point is a lot of people have said that despite the abundance of information, it isn't sort of user-friendly to people that are affected, despite, I think, the great efforts of all the panel members, by the way, and the co-chair of trying to make it so. And so that's, I think that's sort of good feedback. On this issue of R&D, I'd like to echo and endorse what Ellen Tahon just said from MSF, but just add a couple of things. One is that we've just done a study of research and development and who pays for clinical trials that are reported in clinicaltrials.gov. And in terms of the trials that are currently reported in this registry of clinical trials, if you look at say, phase 1 through phase 3 trials, which are the trials associated with the development and registration of new drugs, 70% of the trials, as weighted by the number of patients in the clinical trials, are on trials that are paid for by the United States government. If you look at the number of trials that are done only by industry, that is to say industry is listed as the only funder of the trial, the number is 15% in the clinicaltrials.gov database, and 22% if you look at partial sponsorship by the industry. And there's about, and if you look at not industry and not the United States government, which is a lot of foreign governments, that's about 12%. And I think that raises kind of an important issue, because I think R&D is important, and I think there has to be a system of rewards and incentives for people to develop drugs. One is that, does it make sense, as Ellen said, to look at farm workers in Guatemala and poor, you know, people all over the world, or people in Africa, to be like the primary source of the R&D revenue through the price of the drugs that they pay? Is that the kind of system that you want, which is what these rules are designed to do? Or do you want to come up with a different set of rewards that separates and delinks the R&D incentive from the price of the drug? So what the agreement that Ellen talked about, the global, the WHO agreement in May, this new global strategy, they said that people have to start delinking R&D incentives from the prices of drugs. What that's a demand for is to have cheap medicine and a separate system of rewards for people that develop drugs. And what's good is that at this AIDS meeting today, that at least two companies, TiboTech and Gilead, have expressed some interest in the idea of experimenting with these kind of reward systems that sort of separate the two markets more. And I think that's really quite important. And politically, Bolivia and Barbados have made a proposal that relates to AIDS to the WHO in this process to create a fund, an R&D fund, for priority medicines, including AIDS treatment, so that the whole world could share in the cost of research on AIDS. And you could think about how you share the burden between, say, Germany, Japan, the United States, countries that have a lot of money, Norway, as well as poor countries. What's the appropriate way to think about doing it? And in the context of this WHO, it's sort of referred to as sort of the R&D treaty process, which is also part of the agreement, and they're going to be discussing that. And some people think that the R&D treaty approach is a competing paradigm or an alternative idea to these stories that these panelists talked about the FTAs. It's the idea, can you get the trade people to focus on an agreement about research and development instead of just really very tough IPR standards for everything? And so that's something else. But sorry for the long comment. If we could go back to the floor, it'd be good. Brooke Baker.
My name is Brooke Baker. I'm also from HealthGap and from Northeastern University School of Law. Many developing countries have not adopted their legislation to take advantage of TRIPS and DOA compliant flexibilities. Many countries, when they have adopted legislation pursuant to free trade agreements, have adopted FTA plus provisions. And I think one of the question to the panelists, but it's also, I guess, a comment or claim, is that a lot of work can still be done in developing countries to go to their legislatures, to mobilize civil society, to make demands within countries that all the flexibilities of the TRIPS agreement and Doha declaration be enacted into legislation and that they be used. And secondly, even the countries that have improvidently entered into free trade agreements with the U.S. can now go backwards and retrofit those in response to the new trade policy in the U.S. So if Guatemala went overboard on FTA plus provisions, civil society could go back to the parliament and say, listen, you didn't have to do that. Congress has now clearly indicated that there are more flexibilities, particularly on even on data exclusivity, and let's go back and revise our legislation. Mobilizing civil society to make those demands within country for domestic legislative change is hard, but it's critically important. I guess one other thing I'd like to say, that in that context, and maybe a little bit in the presentations, the drug industry is the puppet masters of, you know, the U.S. Trade Representative and of the European Commission. And it's very useful if people combine campaigns against drug companies at the same time that they have campaigns against FTAs. Because many of the very successful social movements that have won against both trade pressure and drug companies have been simultaneous. So in South Africa, it was a campaign not only against U.S. trade pressure, but also against the lawsuit by 39 drug companies. And in India, it was not only the defense of the Indian Patent Act, but also the defense against Narvaez's attack on it. And in Thailand, it was an attack, partially on the FDA and defense of compulsory licenses, but then against Abbott for its extraordinarily human rights violation retaliation by withdrawing Kaletra and other medicines from the market. So I would urge us when we are thinking about our campaigns to continue to put the corporate puppet masters in the picture, because those are targets that people can identify with very easily.
Thank you, Brooke. Next speaker.
Hi. sorry. I am from Mexico City. Are you listening to me? Yes? Okay. And I'm from Mexico City, so welcome to Mexico for all of you. And I want to speak in Spanish, so si me gusta hacer la traducción tú, por favor. Son dos preguntas rápidas. Ya agarré de la doctora, perdón. Básicamente, yo creo que no me entra en la cabeza, tal vez, el problema aquí que se plantea son las patentes. Y las patentes de estos derechos intelectuales y todo lo demás, a fin de cuentas están matando gente. Si el incentivo económico de los investigadores de las farmacéuticas es el económico, pues esa avaricia está matando gente, entonces que se dediquen a hacer otra cosa. Mi pregunta directa es, ¿por qué no socializar los modelos de salud en los países con mayor concentración de personas con VIH? ¿Sí, por qué no socializar los modelos de salud? ¿Por qué no adoptar, por ejemplo, el modelo cubano? El modelo cubano que tiene un modelo de socialización donde todos los tienen acceso libre a los medicamentos, a los tratamientos, y donde tienen medicina preventiva. Porque el 95% de las personas infectadas con VIH se infectan por relaciones sexuales, y hasta donde yo sé, nadie llega a una relación sexual por casualidad. Todo es prevenible. Entonces la medicina, ¿por qué no? La pregunta concreta es, ¿por qué no prevenir y socializar los modelos de salud en los países más afectados? Gracias.
His question is, why don't we socialize the health model in our countries to access to health for everyone, like Cuba, that they have a universal access to health.
Okay, I actually set up this session, and I'm, the issue of setting up this session came up, and I said FTAs in the context of HIV, all the committee members said that's not an issue in HIV. So I'm really happy that we got the speakers and we got the audience. But I have to apologize to my South African friend, and I'm telling you very frankly that I asked my friend Mark Haywood and people from TAC, and they couldn't give me the names from Africa, and we were restricted. So next time, definitely Africa will be on the thing. One. Secondly, I think the person from ACT UP or HealthCap asked, and rightly, because that's the purpose of this session, what are we going to do about it? And I think one of the things that we must do is to make this issue very simple, and this simplicity and conveying the information to activists is very, very important. Now, Clearinghouse, in terms of big bilateral .org, is all available. But information is not being made in a simple manner available to activists. And if activists know that this is going on, then they can do something about it. It's unlike a case either in South Africa or India, which was high profile. These are all done secretly behind closed doors, and that's what Ellen said. So it's very difficult to pin yourself down. But I think we need to simplify and tell people this is what's going on, and try to make hotspots whenever there's an FTA being organized by either the European Union or the US. Last point I want to make is that, when people say that why is this happening, I look back into history. And, if you read about the TRIPS agreement, the US Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, and Brooke is very right, it's the USTR just is a puppet of that organization. You have to just see the two websites. And you know, they're echoing each other. Fortunately now, the Democrats have cooled down, and hopefully, if you have a president in the U.S. who is slightly more amenable, then you can do better things. But they had an agenda right from the beginning of harmonization of intellectual property laws. And TRIPS was just an interim measure. And they want to complete their agenda. And that's why data exclusivity, that's why patent linkages, etc., etc. And we need to bring that to the health movement. And the health movement is very active. The HIV groups are very active. They don't know about this information. Final point I want to make is the lady in the right who said, what about human rights issues? The right to health is the most important right. And I happen to be the special rapporteur from 1st of August. And one of the things that I want to take up is FTAs. So I think we should make that as an issue and make sure that themes are taken up there. Because according to me, it's very important that FTAs, which actually impede the right to health, must be stopped. And I'm very happy to note that you also agree with me that the Europeans are very sensitive to the rightful criticism that they're impeding the right to health. But for that purpose, I've told people that I'm going to convene consultations in different parts of the region on theme or country-wise or region issues. So I'll need your help on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank you for organizing this session.
I have two brief questions. I'm Emmy McLean from the United States. I am grateful to hear about the defensive actions that you're talking about, but I would just invite you to speak a little bit more about some of the more ambitious offensive actions that I know people have been engaged in, looking beyond just responding out of necessity to the free trade agreements that are in the works. And also, I was pleased to hear, Jamie, you mention some of the developments within the pharmaceutical industry of a couple companies who are willing to look at different strategies. And I would just be interested in hearing a little bit more about positive changes that you might be seeing within the pharmaceutical companies, either as a whole or individual companies. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to go to the panel right now, and then we had several speakers. We had the gentleman from Mexico. We had Brooke. We had Anne. We had the most recent speaker from the United States. Well, I think we'll go in the same order. We'll start as always with Ms. Lopez.
Well, I think I only have to say to Brooke that I totally agree with him and that we need and we should keep moving and going to the Congress and having this conversation with our congressmen and congresswomen. And yes, we have to move those legislation backwards because they are restricting access to health and to ARV. And to this friend from Mexico, the same thing. I totally agree with him that health is not an emergency. It's a human right, as Anand mentioned it. And the access to health is it's a human right, and we should move forward to that.
Thank you. I also agree with Brooke. I mean, even if your country is not signing a free trade agreement, I think almost every country's patent law in the world can do with some improvements to add the safeguards like compulsory licensing and make it easier and make it cheaper, parallel importation. But of course, if there is a free trade agreement on the horizon and the negotiations are starting, then of course you can campaign and lobby to try and either stop it or make it not TRIPS Plus. And if your country has signed a free trade agreement, as Brooke pointed out, it's not the end of the world. I mean, it's bad, but you can make the implementation less worse. Instead of the Guatemala example, where I think there was four pages of implementing laws that the USTR checked and said, this is not far enough, you must go even further than the FTA, your parliament could take a robust role, and because there's always room to interpret these treaties. You can take a pro-health interpretation or you can take a pro-intellectual property interpretation. So there is always a fight you can have, even at the implementing stage, to make it less worse and go for the pro-health interpretation. And I also agree, well, first to talk about that it is possible to do these things, so it may seem complicated, but the example I always like, even though I'm not from Thailand, is the Thai PLHIV have done amazing things. So even Thai villagers from the far north of Thailand can tell you that the Thai patent law, Section 52, compulsory licensing provision, is not good enough because it takes too long to issue. These are people with no university education, maybe no even primary or secondary education, but they know. Why do they know? Because it's life and death for them. It's about their medicines. So I think in Thailand the way it worked was, because of resource constraints, the village clinics could only give out antiretrovirals once a month on the same day. So all PLHIV would go to the clinic on the same day to collect their medicines. Since they were all there together, they had peer support groups on that day. First they talked about what is the medicine, what is treatment, what is adherence. And then gradually, month after month, they said, what is a patent? Why is it important to you? How it makes your medicines more expensive? Then they said, what is a compulsory license? And they can do this with pictures. Even Lawyers Collective also does it in India. Then they went through, what is the free trade agreement with the US? How does it affect you? Why is it important? So then the first time the US came to negotiate intellectual property in their free trade agreement, I think they had 10,000 people on the streets of Chiang Mai in the far north of Thailand, most of whom were PLHIV, sleeping on the streets for 5 days, and they were so effective they stopped the negotiators from even getting into the venue. They had to move the negotiations 20 kilometres down the road to a golf course, and at the end, the Thai chief negotiator came out and he thanked the demonstrators. He said, thanks to you, I could resist the US in the negotiating room because I could point outside to the demonstrations and say, look, I can't give you what you want on patents because these people, there will be riots, there will be civil war, there will be demonstrations. I'm sorry. So it actually strengthened his hand. And the South Korean negotiators said the same thing about the beef aspects of their free trade agreement. Just in the last month or two, you would have seen. They went to negotiate with the US. They took photos of the demonstrators. And when the US pressed them, they said, look, a million people on the streets, what do you want me to do? My whole cabinet has had to resign. I'm sorry, I just can't give in. So you can see that it does reinforce the position of your governments to try and withstand these pressures. And in Thailand, the PLHIV succeeded. A campaign over years, and they got patents withdrawn. They got compulsory licenses issued, some of the best compulsory licensing in the world, all through PLHIV, basically. People in the villages who, a few years ago, didn't even know what a patent was. So it's definitely possible. I also agree with the previous questioners who said that the influence of the pharmaceutical industry is very strong. They took out an advertisement in The Economist, Asian edition, the CEO of Pfizer, who said, I wrote the TRIPS agreement. I'm the one who got the world to go from no patents on medicines to 20 years of monopoly on medicines. It's thanks to me. And basically, they are on the US Trade Department's advisory committees. So they write what goes into the trade agreements, and they put what they want. I just thought I should also add that to the debate about IP and innovation, I forgot to say that the whole of the developing country market, like how much pharmaceutical they buy a year, is less than 1% or 6% or something of the world market. So whether or not they have 50-year patents or 20-year patents won't make much difference to the profitability of a multinational pharmaceutical company. And I should also point out that even the European Union's study that they commissioned on the free trade agreements or economic partnership agreements that do not have intellectual property provisions, just looking at lowering the taxes on goods, on products, would already be bad for poverty, bad for hunger, bad for education, and bad for health. Why is this? Because in some developing countries, well, in all developing countries, taxes on exports and imports are the easiest way for the government to collect money. It's very difficult for them to do a corporate tax system or an income tax system. So in some developing countries, 80% of the government's money comes from taxes on imports. A free trade agreement with the European Union requires you to reduce to zero taxes on 80% of the Europeans' products. For a US free trade agreement, it's taxes on 100% of their products, except maybe one line if you're lucky. So, your government budget, where are you getting your money from? So then the government budget goes down. How do they pay for doctors, nurses, hospitals, medicines? Unemployment goes up because your local farmers and workers can't compete. So even as our Mexican friend said, if you have a universal access to health system, like Thailand, like Malaysia, where the government basically gives medicines for free, including antiretrovirals, the government can't afford it anymore if they sign one of these free trade agreements. Number one, because their revenue goes down. And number two, because their intellectual property means the prices go up. So even if your medicines come from a funder like the Global Fund, if you have to have patents on your medicines, their money also goes less far.
We're just about the time. I mean, we have a great panel, and they are incredibly well informed, and we have 2 minutes before our allotted time is over. So I just wanted to give Gabriella a chance to comment.
Very quickly, Ellen. Just saying to Anam that the implementation of universal access to medicines is a crucial component of the AIDS response in the different contexts, and to avoid TRIPS plus provision as well as new monopolistic strategies that we are finding in our context is part of this fight. So we are happy that you will be fighting this as a special rapporteur for health.
A final comment. I think Anand is quite right that there is a very deliberate strategy to ratchet up IP protection globally to ever higher levels. And time has really come. Actually, it's well overdue to say stop. We've had enough. There needs to be a pushback. And I think that the global debate that is at the same time taking place today about different ways of financing the research and development, move away from monopolies as a way to doing that, to different kinds of incentive mechanisms, can really help to do that. Because we will always be confronted with the question, if there aren't patents, if there isn't more IP, how are we going to have more research and development? And it will really help if we can say, well, here are a few examples of how you can do that differently. So I think we need to combine these fights and with the aim to stop that push to have ever higher levels of IP protection with all the negative consequences that come with it.
Yes, I think we... I find that too. I'm going to just one comment and close the session. Thank all the people that the organizers and all the panel members in the audience, which has been contributed a lot, and the excellent questions we've had. So many people have been working on these issues. I would just say, as a personal thing, picking up on the point that Ellen made, is that it's my hope and it's my dream, personally, that the social movement that you're part of and that we're part of can transform the entire trade agenda into this new paradigm where you no longer expect high drug prices to be the primary go-to measure to finance new drug development. As long as that's the deal, you can't be shocked when there's all these things coming at you to raise drug prices, because that's just by design. That's kind of the initial position we have is a bad idea. High drug prices is where you go to get money for R&D. So what's really great, what's really amazing right now is in 2008, the World Health Assembly, by consensus, including the European Union and the United States government and Japan, agreed to consider the delinking of R&D with the price of the product, to consider a biomedical R&D treaty, to consider the idea of things like prizes as an incentive for the development of new drugs as opposed to the granting of monopolies. And there's concrete proposals, there's things that are taking place. But it's something that's, because it's new, it doesn't really have, there's not enough information about it, there's not enough knowledge in patient groups and things, because they're still basically focused on the legacy issues of the free trade agreements and dealing with the things, which is important because that's reality where we are right now. And if you don't do that, then people are going to die. So that comes first. But there is, I think, some hope for optimism, but also some very, very tough fights that have to be fought, as outlined by the panel members. And thank everyone for coming here. Thank you.